Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that sometimes gets lost in the film library of our collective mind. Once in a while, we stumble upon an aisle we haven't been down in some time, and there on a dusty shelf, we spy a movie that we saw, sometimes decades ago, that we remember loving. Yet for some reason, we haven't rewatched it. Maybe it was because it wasn't available, or maybe it was because we were afraid that the film just wouldn't hold up. And that fantasy gave us an idea. Each of us would pick a film that we once saw, a film that we remember adoring, and we would watch it again. And the point? To see if it was as good as we once thought. Anyway, that's what we did. And we're going to begin by, well, Nathan, why don't you start?
Well, the movie that I picked to revisit, the reason I haven't watched it in a long time is the latter category that you mentioned, which is I was worried that it would not hold up for a number of reasons. But the movie that I went with is from the year 2000 by Cameron Crowe, and that's Almost Famous. And to give you some context, this was Cameron Crowe's fourth film as a writer and director. It was his follow-up to Jerry Maguire, which was a massive hit. And I don't think he's had a hit as big as Jerry Maguire
You
since.
Complete me.
Yes. There's so many catchphrases. Show me the money, Dan. And this film, Almost Famous, was based on Crowe's own teenage years because when he was a kid, he became obsessed with rock and roll. And by the time he was 15 or 16, he was actually contributing articles to Rolling Stone and Cream, which are two of the formative rock magazines of the early 1970s. And it was in their first decades that Crowe was a regular contributor. It was also around that time that Rolling Stone sent this 16-year-old kid on a tour with the Allman Brothers Band, because what could go wrong with that?
Yeah.
And of course, this was back in the time when magazines had the budget to send writers on the road for weeks or months at a time to really get to know their sources. And so those experiences informed Almost Famous. In the film, Crowe's avatar is named William Miller. He's played by Patrick Fugit. And the Allman Brothers are represented by a band called Stillwater, yeah, which never existed, and is fronted by a guy named Russell Hammond, played brilliantly, I think, by Billy Crudup.
Who looks almost exactly like Dickie Betts of the Allman Brothers.
Sure, yeah. And I think they're sort of an amalgam of a lot of different mm-hmm. bands from that era. But this movie just has such a stellar cast. I mean, this was where we first saw Kate Hudson, really. Mm-hmm. She plays Penny Lane, one of the Stillwater groupies. Her only Academy Award nomination for this movie, and she is just – it makes sense that she became a movie star after this, because it is one of those I can't look away from this person kind of performances. And again, I don't think she's ever come close to touching this. You have Philip Seymour Hoffman, the late, great Philip Seymour Hoffman, as Lester Bangs, rock
perfect
critic.
Casting.
Such perfect casting. And Frances McDormand as William Miller's mother, who spends most of the movie on the phone worried about her son. And yet,
with justification,
she should be worried. That is the kind of role that so many movies, including other Cameron Crowe movies, have wasted. The mother that's haranguing her son on the phone. And yet Frances McDormand brings so much soul and so much humor to that performance. It's one of her very best turns. And so I don't remember the first time I saw this movie. It must have been in high school or middle school, and it obviously made an impression on me because it's about, you know, a precocious young writer who wants to go out into the real world and do, you know, big boy writing assignments. And of course, Cameron Crowe is, you know, he really did that, which is crazy impressive, and I don't know if it could be done again today. The reason I was worried about going back and revisiting it is that I was – well, mainly Cameron Crowe hasn't made a good movie since Almost Famous, I would say. I also haven't seen Vanilla Sky in a long time. Maybe that holds up, but I don't think so.
No, go see the Spanish original.
Oh, well, sure. That is better. And so I was worried that his brand of optimism that spoke to me so much as a teenager would just seem cloying now that I'm, you know, a cynical adult. But I have to say, I watched this a few nights ago. I think it holds up pretty beautifully, and for all the reasons I mentioned, the cast obviously, but just that sense of authenticity. It also has a sense of kind of rose-colored fantasy about it in a way, because he's clearly remembering an era from the most optimistic time in his life. And so you see all this sadness and cynicism and kind of jaundiced worldviews around William Miller, all of the musicians who are like, you know, this life isn't all that great. But he's thinking, no, you're a rock star. You're on the road. It's so great. And so I just love that kind of sweet and sour sort of flavor that you get from this one. So, yeah, I really loved this movie again.
And it's hard to say about any of these films, do they, quote, hold up? Because I think the question that I sort of asked, did I enjoy or appreciate watching it now in the same way or a different way than I did X years ago when I saw it. But I really enjoyed watching Almost Famous because of its sweetness and because of the performances. And, you know, and then we know what happens to these people later in their careers. And that in and of itself is intriguing.
Yeah. And I, too, enjoyed watching it as much as I enjoyed watching it the first time around, which is, I would say, a B plus, because I just feel like Crowe started getting into a point where he couldn't edit his film down to something that was more manageable. I thought there were a lot of scenes that just went on and on and on and became repetitive. But I loved the casting, and I particularly loved one scene that has stayed with me for years, and that is the tiny dancer scene in the bus where after a big fight between all these people, they all come back together, if only for this moment.
And it's
a beautiful scene.
And it's that kind of scene that Cameron Crowe has sort of made his reputation on. And there are times when he will do scenes like that, and you're like, I'm going to be sick because it's so sweet and it's so cloying. For some reason, the sweetness in this movie works. And I don't know if it's just one of – maybe it's because he was so personally attached to the material. It seems to be coming from such an earnest and believable, authentic place, some of the scenes aren't totally authentic.
The primary character, William Miller, is this innocent. Mm-hmm. You know, he does have this naivete. And so I think some of these –
And the movie
sweet
reflects
scenes,
it.
Right, that you mentioned could be cloying in other contexts work here.
And that was our discussion of Cameron Crowe's film Almost Famous, which Nathan shared with us. But Mary Pat, now let's move to you. You have a movie that you want to share.
I do. And it's also a musically themed film. And maybe this would be a good companion piece to Almost Famous.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yin and yang. Yeah.
Right.
Sort of.
So I chose the movie Sid and Nancy about Sid Vicious and his girlfriend. And
Nancy
it's a 1986 film directed by Alex Cox, who had a very intriguing career on multiple levels. He directed Repo Man before this film, which got a lot of attention. Then he directs Sid and Nancy. And then he worked for years and years on this film about William Walker and the Mexican Central American revolutionary that just didn't get any traction. And he also worked through the writer's strike. And so he was blackballed. And now he's actually teaching, because those who can't do teach, don't you know? But at any rate, so Alex Cox directed this film. Roger Deakins, the famous Roger Deakins, did the cinematography. And so you know that you're going to get some amazing shots throughout the movie. But the real focal point of this film is the relationship between Sid Vicious and Nancy Spungen, who connect up and form this pathological unity that is difficult to explain. But there is, you know, a sweetness somewhere beneath the violence, beneath the hard drugs and so forth. And it's the performances, I think, by Gary Oldman and by Chloe Webb that make this movie. And so this was one of those films that was sort of like a litmus test for my and Dan's relationship, along with Reservoir Dogs. So I don't know what that says about us.
Can you explain that? What do you mean by a litmus test?
It's when we first met and we were first getting together. The very moment we met, we got into an argument, a very civil argument about the movie, the French movie Encore en Hiver. I didn't like it. She did. But then beyond that, we had to talk about other movies that we shared a passion for. One was Reservoir Dogs. The other was Sid and Nancy.
Well, so on brand for your continuing relationship.
Yes.
Yeah, I guess so.
We met in an argument.
We did.
About a French
civilized
film.
Civilized argument, right.
Yeah.
So Gary Oldman did not want to do this movie. As a matter of fact, Alex Cox had picked Daniel Day-Lewis.
Wouldn't that
have been a different portrayal?
Yeah.
But Gary Oldman finally conceded and agreed to do it. And then Courtney Love was actually auditioned, and she does have a small role in this film, to play the Nancy role. And they ultimately decided to go with somebody who was, quote, a bigger star. And that's what's interesting. Chloe Webb got a number of nominations for different, not an Oscar, Academy Award, but did get nominated for a variety of acting awards and actually won some of them for this movie. But then her career sort of took a side turn. Some of you might recognize her because she's most recently appeared or showed up again in Shameless, the William Macy series on Showtime. So some of you might recognize her from that. Mm-hmm. And so we can talk a little bit more about what I liked about the movie. And I really would like Nathan to weigh in on the sort of punk rock scene that's a framing device for this film.
Yeah, but before we do that, we need to take a short break. We've been discussing the 2000 Cameron Crowe film Almost Famous and Alex Cox's 1986 film Sid and Nancy. This is Movies 101. Before we go here, remember that you can access podcasts of our show by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to continue our look back at films we once loved and discussing whether we still feel the same today. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
Find your art and entertainment options when you visit the online community calendar at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Check out events throughout the Inland Northwest, whether you're in Spokane, Sandpoint, the Metau, Spokane Valley, or anywhere in between. Go to SpokanePublicRadio.org. Look for the colored pencil graphic and click to find events or submit your own. SPR works to encourage the arts in a variety of ways, including the online community calendar.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of this special edition of our show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed the 2000 film Almost Famous as part of our exercise in looking back at films we once loved and sharing whether our affection remains the same. Then Mary Pat revealed her choice, Alex Cox's 1986 film Sid and Nancy. Let's continue that discussion, MP.
This is a film about love and codependency and drugs. And also about music.
Self-destruction.
Right. So many different themes going on. And I'm not sure I was attracted to this movie because of its music perspective, because the Sex Pistols were really a relatively short-lived phenomenon, but they became this cultural sort of touchstone for everything that the good, the bad, and the ugly that punk represented. And I was more familiar with the punk music scene through the New York Dolls and the Ramones and Clash, not so much through this. But I know we do have a music expert among us, so tell.
What's interesting about the Sex Pistols is that they were both, you know, kind of anti-establishment, but also embraced by the establishment in the sense that they were putting up their two fingers at the monarchy, but they were also, you know, writing best-selling songs. They were topping the charts.
And wearing designer garb.
Yes. And they were sort of a packaged deal by Malcolm McLaren, who also went on to do bands like Bow Wow Wow. And I think what's interesting about this film, though, is you do see, in terms of a biopic perspective, and John Lydon, also known as Johnny Rotten, who is rotten as a person anyway, but
he's still alive, yeah, amazingly so.
He has said that this movie is a lot of lies, and maybe that's because he does not come across all that well in it. But you can see that he and the other members of the Sex Pistols are trying to forge a career because
to have a band.
Yes, because they want to be a band and they are musicians. Whereas Sid Vicious was a real gutter punk kid that they basically added to the band because he gave them authenticity that they didn't have, because they were sort of, you know, they were fronting in a sense, even though they did inspire a lot of grungier punk bands after the fact. So it's interesting to see that dynamic here. And going back to Gary Oldman's performance, I mean, 1986. Obviously, musical biopics had existed, and shortly before this, you know, you had Sissy Spacek as Loretta Lynn, you had Gary Busey as Buddy Holly performing their own interpretations of music by those artists. I think that at this time, the idea of a performer throwing themselves completely into the role of a performer was still kind of a novelty. Mm-hmm. I feel like it happens all the time now. And Gary Oldman, even though he wasn't the first, kind of set the precedent for this sort of performance.
I think what's amazing is how good they both were, Chloe Webb and Gary
and
Oldman.
And she sometimes gets overlooked in conversations
absolutely.
Of this
She's
movie.
Not had a career. This was the glowing moment of her career. But it's a moment that actors would kill for.
And again, we talked about Frances McDormand in Almost Famous. Nancy could have been a thankless role. It could have been a ragdoll kind of performance, and she doesn't play it that way.
Exactly. And that was our discussion of Alex Cox's 1986 film, Sid and Nancy. Let's close with something that I chose. Sometime in the 1970s, when I was still living in Eugene, Oregon, I caught a little film released in 1977 that was screened one afternoon on the local public television channel. It was directed by a then-still-unknown British director named Ridley Scott. And on paper, it had everything going against it. It was the first feature film by Scott. It was an adaptation of a Joseph Conrad story, the Polish-born Conrad having written some of the densest English prose imaginable. It was a period piece set during the Napoleonic Wars of the early 19th century. And perhaps most questionable of all, it starred two American actors, Keith Carradine and Harvey Keitel, as a pair of French army officers who carry on a series of duels over the course of a decade and a half. Despite all that, it worked when I first saw it, and it still works, at least for me, today. Scott's cinematographer, the underrated Frank Tidy, helped him construct scenes that feel like landscape paintings. The set design was flawless. Gerald von Hughes' screenplay made Conrad into something far more easily digestible. And both Carradine, but especially Keitel, play their respective characters far better than expected, especially since they were performing with a superb English cast consisting of Tom Conti, Alan Armstrong, Edward Fox, Diana Quick, John McHenry, Robert Stevens, and the great Albert Finney. All in all, re-seeing The Duelist merely reinforces my contention that it, hardly remembered or even noticed today, remains the prolific Scott's best contribution to cinema.
Whoa.
Yep.
Now there's a
throwdown.
That's right. Them's dueling words right there.
Right.
And I think that everything that he's done since then has been less of a film.
Okay.
So we're struggling here a little bit because there are so many good points about this film, and then there are some other points. So I think that, the cinematography is amazing at different points. And I think that we've talked about this. It's almost like there are individual paintings from these different scenarios that take place over time. The most controversial aspect of this film may be not the cinematography or the direction, but the casting choices. And maybe that's due to the fact that, and that's why I think a historical piece is always going to hold up in a way. You can't say, although we may have different perspectives on history and so forth. But I think the problem for me watching The Duelist is we know what happens to the two main actors subsequently, and it's hard for me to erase the Harvey Keitel of Bad Lieutenant, for example, from my vision of what happens here.
I was going to say, even before this movie, because Harvey Keitel was in
Mean Streets, Taxi Driver,
and Keith Carradine was in Nashville. So, mm-hmm. Two incredibly American actors playing members of Napoleon's army.
Right. So, Dan, you insist, and I'm not going to dispute your film expertise or your vision or your perspective, that these two actors—
Well, if you did, you'd be wrong. So,
did an excellent job. And I don't disagree with that, but at the same time, they're so incongruous. They seem like such anomalous
choices. But, that's all part— we've talked a little bit about this off-screen, and Nathan, I want you to jump in here because— To say that they're incongruous, everything about what goes on in this film is incongruous. The ridiculousness of war, the ridiculousness of the duel, the ridiculousness of the fashions, the ridiculousness of the fact that these two guys, they can't duel if there's a war on, and they can't duel if they're not the same rank. Everything about it is so ridiculous. I think that the casting of the two actors, which is probably the only reason that Scott was able to raise the money to make this movie, is to get these two actors who were pretty hot at the time. I think that just fits into the total ridiculousness of the film. But rather than, for me, rather than detracting from the greatness of it, it just adds to it.
Well, and I want to compare this to a movie that was released 2 years before The Duelist, which is Stanley Kubrick's Barry Lyndon, which I think this movie probably
owes. With Ryan O'Neill.
Yeah, well, I was going to get to that because I think this movie owes a great deal to Barry Lyndon in terms of its look, because you do have these low light settings. Every shot kind of looks like a pastoral painting. Yes. And you also have the element of casting, because for a long time, everyone has always said the great sticking point of Barry Lyndon is that Ryan O'Neill is lousy as Barry Lyndon. But I think that casting works because he's supposed to be a blank slate. Barry Lyndon is the most boring character in his life story. That's sort of the joke of Barry Lyndon.
And that's Ryan O'Neill as an actor.
Exactly. And so it was actually kind of perfect casting. That's slightly different from casting Martin Scorsese regular Harvey Keitel as a French lieutenant.
But he's a badass.
And here's the thing. I think the performances are fine. And after a while, I was able to accept them, especially Keith Carradine, because he's on screen way more than Harvey Keitel is. But as long as I've known Dan, he's been talking about The Duelist. He's been saying it was Scott's first movie. It's one of the best movies I've ever seen. And I never watched it until last night. And I liked it, too. I thought it was really good.
I messed it up too much.
And I thought the ending in particular hit me a lot harder than I expected it to. Because, as you said, the premise itself is kind of absurd. It's like a Monty Python sketch. Like, we're just going to keep dueling until, you know, we chop each other up one piece at a time. But, yeah, I mean, you do know that Ridley Scott directed Alien and Blade Runner, right?
Yeah.
And you're saying this is his best film?
Yes, because it was.
Okay.
Yes, I still do.
Okay.
I still do say that. Go back. We need to do a special show about going back and looking at those and seeing the problems there are, not necessarily with Alien, but certainly Blade Runner. I mean, I've seen that a couple of times since, and I see flaws. I go, oh, why did he do that?
I don't know. These might be fighting words.
These definitely
speaking
are fighting
of duels.
Words. Yes, speaking of the duels, which, by the way, if we had it, you both would lose.
What are we if not duelists?
Yeah, cinematic
verbal
duelists,
yes.
At any rate. That was Ridley Scott's 1977 great film, The Duelist, and this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster. Earlier in this special edition of the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Mary Pat Truthart, and I discussed Almost Famous and Sid and Nancy as part of our look back at films we once loved to see if our feelings remain the same today. Let's take this moment to thank Peter Glarberg for both producing and engineering the show, and we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer, wherever we can find it. Until then, remember these words from the author A.D. Posey. Film gives us a second chance at a first impression. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.